From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
7 years ago tomorrow, I read my own political obituary in a judgment that seemed to me harsh and mistaken, if not premature. But that unwelcome verdict also brought a precious, if painful, gift, an opportunity to search for fresh new ways to serve my purpose. Unexpectedly, that quest has brought me here.
The 2007 Nobel Peace Prize goes to Al Gore and the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and its chair, Rajendra Pachauri.
Honoring the IPCC through the grant of the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007, in essence, can be seen as a clarion call for the protection of the Earth as it faces the widespread impacts of climate change.
Today, the two Nobel speeches. And we'll talk to an environmentalist who's in the 99th day of a climate emergency fast in Washington, D.C. Today, he'll sit in at the offices of Republican Mitch McConnell for protesting the Democrats' energy bill, for blocking it. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Dozens of Israeli tanks and armored vehicles backed by attack aircraft have invaded the Gaza Strip in the largest Israeli military operation in the area in months. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports Israeli forces have killed at least 8 Palestinians. The raid comes a day before Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli President Ehud Olmert hold their first set of talks since the Annapolis summit. The New York Times is reporting lawyers within the clandestine branch of the CIA gave written approval to the destruction in 2005 of hundreds of hours of videotapes documenting interrogations of 2 prisoners at secret CIA prisons. Today, CIA Director General Michael Hayden is scheduled to appear before a closed session of the Senate Intelligence Committee to answer questions about the destruction of the tapes. Meanwhile, a leader of the CIA team that conducted one of the videotaped interrogations has admitted the CIA tortured the al-Qaeda operative Abu Zubaydah. Retired CIA agent John Kiriakou said subjecting Zubaydah to waterboarding was torture but necessary. Kiriakou told ABC News Zubaydah began to cooperate with interrogators after he was waterboarded. The state of New Jersey has taken a major step toward becoming the first state to abolish the death penalty in more than 40 years. On Monday, the state Senate voted to replace the death sentence with life without parole. The bill has support from New Jersey's Democratic-controlled Assembly and Democratic Governor John Corzine. Earlier this year, a special state commission determined the death penalty was a more expensive sentence than life in prison and has not deterred murder. The Canadian press baron Conrad Black was sentenced to 6.5 years in jail for fleecing millions of dollars from shareholders of his company, Hollinger International. Black's media empire included the Daily Telegraph in London, the Chicago Sun-Times, the Jerusalem Post, National Post in Canada, and 400 other newspapers. Black was also ordered to return $6.1 million and pay a $125,000 fine. U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald said he hoped Black's sentencing will send a message to corporate America.
We're gratified that what happened in the court today should send a message to people who would even think about corporate fraud. Conrad Black was sentenced to 6.5 years. Anyone else who would think about stealing money from shareholders by taking money without permission, by committing fraud and deceiving shareholders, should think very, very seriously about the consequences that happened to Mr. Black.
Black remains free on bail until March 3rd, when he will report to prison. In legal news, the Federal Sentencing Committee is meeting today in light of the Supreme Court ruling on Monday that federal judges can ignore sentencing guidelines and impose shorter sentences for crack cocaine crimes to make them more in line with those of powder cocaine. The sentencing panel will decide whether to retroactively reduce crack sentences in a move that could cut prison time for more than 19,000 prisoners. Under the current guidelines, possession of 5 grams of crack triggers a 5-year mandatory sentence, while it would take 100 times that amount to trigger a similar 5-year mandatory sentence for possession of powder cocaine, which is essentially the same drug in a different form. The disparity has been challenged by civil rights groups because crack is more often used by African Americans, powder cocaine by whites. A woman in Houston, Texas, has sued the company Halliburton and its former subsidiary KBR after she says she was gang raped by employees of the company in Baghdad. Jamie Lee Jones, who was working for KBR at the time, says she was raped by multiple men at a KBR camp in the Green Zone. Jones accuses the company and the U.S. government of covering up the incident. Jones told ABC News after she was raped, the company put her in a shipping container without food or water for at least 24 hours. She was also warned that if she left Iraq for medical treatment, she'd be out of a job. No one's been prosecuted for the rape. ABC News reported the alleged assailants will likely never face a judge and jury due to a loophole that's effectively left contractors in Iraq beyond the reach of United States law. U.S.-backed Afghan President Hamid Karzai is calling on the international community to send more troops to fight in Afghanistan.
At the same time, we would like to have the international community continue to add to the building of the Afghan forces, continue to add to the Afghanization of this whole exercise, so that Afghanistan can be ready in time to take on the responsibility of defending the Afghan country with Afghan institutions and Afghan ability.
Karzai spoke in Kabul during a meeting with visiting British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. In Algeria, at least 47 people have died in two bomb blasts in the capital, Algiers. One of the blasts destroyed part of the United Nations offices. In news from Washington, Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, has dropped his appeal in a perjury case stemming from the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Libby was found guilty in March of lying and obstructing an investigation into who blew Plame's cover after her husband, Joseph Wilson, criticized the Iraq War. President Bush commuted Libby's two-and-a-half-year prison sentence in July, but Libby still had to pay a $250,000 fine. President Bush has not ruled out a full pardon for Libby. A new report from Human Rights Watch says the crackdown by the military junta in Burma on pro-democracy protests in September was far deadlier than Burmese officials have let on. Steve Crawshaw, the United Nations Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch.
Is a horrendous series of killings and brutality with both live bullets and beatings during the protests of the last couple of months. The government says that everything is back to normal. Our report makes it clear that that is absolutely not the case. Arrests are continuing, and we've seen a series of very brutal actions, which I think the world really needs to wake up to.
The New York-based human rights group documented at least 20 deaths of students, civilians, and Buddhist monks in Rangoon, but said many more were likely to have died in the former Burma main city and nationwide. Official Burmese media have admitted 10 people died in the crackdown, including a Japanese video journalist shot dead at point-blank range. In New Mexico, a Catholic priest and a retired Catholic lay leader have been jailed without bail for taking part in a nonviolent protest against U.S. torture practices outside Fort Huachuca, home of the U.S. Army Intelligence Center and school. A judge ordered Father Jerry Zawada and Betsy Lamb to remain in jail because they'd failed to heed orders in other cases. In October, two other Catholic priests, Steve Kelly and Louis Vitale, were sentenced to 5 months in prison for taking part in another anti-torture protest at Fort Huachuca. And South Korea is continuing to fight the worst oil spill in the country's history 4 days after over 10,000 tons of crude oil leaked from a Hong Kong ship. Oil has now washed up along more than 25 miles of the Korean Peninsula's west coast. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Nobel Peace Prize was awarded Monday to former Vice President Al Gore and the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change for their work to help combat global warming. The UN's climate panel has brought together 2,500 researchers from more than 130 nations. Al Gore has emerged as a leading environmental campaigner since his failed bid for the presidency 7 years ago. His Academy Award-winning documentary, An Inconvenient Truth, is credited with reaching a vast new audience on the dangers of global warming. The Nobel Awards ceremony was held at City Hall in Oslo, Norway. Today we play the acceptance speeches, beginning with Al Gore.
I have a purpose here today. It is a purpose I've tried to serve for many years. I have prayed that God would show me a way to accomplish it. Sometimes, without warning, the future knocks on our door with a precious and painful vision of what might be. 119 years ago, a wealthy inventor read his own obituary, mistakenly published years before his death. Wrongly believing the inventor had just died, a newspaper printed a harsh judgment of his life's work, unfairly labeling him the merchant of death because of his invention, dynamite. Shaken by this condemnation, the inventor made a fateful choice to serve the cause of peace. 7 years later, Alfred Nobel created this prize and the others that bear his name. 7 years ago tomorrow, I read my own political obituary in a judgment that seemed to me harsh and mistaken, if not premature. But that unwelcome verdict also brought a precious, if painful, gift, an opportunity to search for fresh new ways to serve my purpose. Unexpectedly, that quest has brought me here. Even though I fear my words cannot match this moment, I pray that what I'm feeling in my heart will be communicated clearly enough that those who hear me will say, we must act. The distinguished scientists with whom it is the greatest honor of my life to share this award have laid before us a choice between two different futures, a choice that to my ears echoes the words of an ancient prophet: life or death, blessings or curses, therefore choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live. We, the human species, are confronting a planetary emergency, a threat to the survival of our civilization that is gathering ominous and destructive potential even as we gather here. But there is hopeful news as well. We have the ability to solve this crisis and avoid the worst, though not all, of its consequences if we act boldly, decisively, and quickly. However, despite a growing number of honorable exceptions, too many of the world's leaders are still best described in the words Winston Churchill applied to those who ignored Adolf Hitler's threat. And I quote, "They go on in strange paradox, decided only to be undecided, resolved to be irresolute, adamant for drift, solid for fluidity, all-powerful to be impotent." So today, we dumped another 70 million tons of global warming pollution into the thin shell of atmosphere surrounding our planet as if it were an open sewer. And tomorrow, we will dump a slightly larger amount, with the cumulative concentrations now trapping more and more heat from the sun. As a result, the Earth has a fever, and the fever is rising. The experts have told us it is not a passing affliction that will heal by itself. We asked for a second opinion, and a third, and a fourth. And the consistent conclusion, restated with increasing distress, is that something basic is wrong. We are what is wrong, and we must make it right. Last September 21st, as the Northern Hemisphere tilted away from the sun, scientists reported with unprecedented alarm that the North Polar ice cap is, in their words, falling off a cliff. One study estimated that it could be completely gone during summer in less than 22 years. Another new study to be presented by U.S. Navy researchers later this week warns it could happen in as little as 7 years. 7 years from now. In the last few months, it has been harder and harder to misinterpret the signs that our world is spinning out of kilter. Major cities in North and South America, Asia, and Australia are nearly out of water due to massive droughts and melting glaciers. Desperate farmers are losing their livelihoods. Peoples in the frozen Arctic and on low-lying Pacific islands are planning evacuations of places they have long called home. Unprecedented wildfires have forced 500,000 people from their homes in one country and caused a national emergency that almost brought down the government in another. Climate refugees have migrated into areas already inhabited by people with different cultures, religions, and traditions, increasing the potential for conflict. Stronger storms in the Atlantic and the Pacific have threatened whole cities. Millions have been displaced by massive flooding in South Asia, Mexico, and 18 countries in Africa. As temperature extremes have increased, tens of thousands have lost their lives. We are recklessly burning and clearing our forests and driving more and more species into extinction. The very web of life on which we depend is being ripped and frayed. We never intended to cause all this destruction, just as Alfred Nobel never intended that dynamite be used for waging war. He had hoped his invention would promote human progress. We shared that same worthy goal when we began burning massive quantities of coal, then oil and natural gas. Even in Nobel's time, there were a few warnings of the likely consequences. One of the very first winners of the prize in chemistry worried that, in his words, we are evaporating our coal mines into the air. After performing 10,000 equations by hand, Svante Arrhenius calculated that the Earth's average temperature would increase by many degrees if we doubled the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. 70 years later, my teacher Roger Revelle and his colleague Dave Keeling began to precisely document the increasing CO2 levels day by day. But unlike most other forms of pollution, CO2 is invisible, tasteless, and odorless, which has helped keep the truth about what it is doing to our climate out of sight and out of mind. Moreover, the catastrophe now threatening us is unprecedented, and we often confuse the unprecedented with the improbable. We also find it hard to imagine making the massive changes that are now necessary to solve the crisis. And when large truths are genuinely inconvenient, whole societies can, at least for a time, ignore them. Yet, as George Orwell reminds us, sooner or later, a false belief bumps up against a solid reality, usually on a battlefield.
Al Gore giving his 2007 Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech in Oslo. We'll come back to that speech, as well as the head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in a minute. Sung at Oslo City Hall as the Nobel Peace Prizes were awarded. We return to former Vice President Al Gore accepting his 2007 Nobel Peace Prize.
In the years since this prize was first awarded, the entire relationship between humankind and the Earth has been radically transformed. And still, we have remained largely oblivious to the impact of our cumulative actions. Indeed, without realizing it, we have begun to wage war on the Earth itself. Now we and the Earth's climate are locked in a relationship familiar to war planners, mutually assured destruction. More than two decades ago, scientists calculated that nuclear war could throw so much debris and smoke into the air it would block life-giving sunlight from our atmosphere, causing a nuclear winter. Their eloquent warnings here in Oslo helped galvanize the world's resolve to halt the nuclear arms race. Now science is warning us that if we do not quickly reduce the global warming pollution that is trapping so much of the heat our planet normally radiates back out of the atmosphere, we are in danger of creating a permanent carbon summer. As the American poet Robert Frost wrote, some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. Either, he notes, would suffice. But neither need be our fate. It is time to make peace with the planet. We must quickly mobilize our civilization with the urgency and resolve that has previously been seen only when nations mobilized for war. These prior struggles for survival were won when leaders found words at the 11th hour that released a mighty surge of courage, hope, and readiness to sacrifice for a protracted and mortal struggle. These were not comforting and misleading assurances that the threat was not real, not imminent, that it would afflict others but not ourselves, that ordinary life might be lived even in the presence of extraordinary threat, that providence could be trusted to do for us what we would not do for ourselves. No, these were calls to come to the defense of the common future. They were calls upon the courage, generosity, and strength of entire peoples, citizens of every class and condition, who were ready to stand against the threat once asked to do so. Our enemies in those times calculated that free people would not rise to the challenge. They were, of course, catastrophically wrong. Now comes the threat of climate crisis, a threat that is real, rising, imminent, and universal. Once again, it is the 11th hour. The penalties for ignoring this challenge are immense and growing, and at some near point would be unsustainable and unrecoverable. For now, we still have the power to choose our fate. And the remaining question is only this: have we the will to act vigorously and in time, or will we remain imprisoned by a dangerous illusion? Mahatma Gandhi awakened the largest democracy on earth and forged a shared resolve with what he called Satyagraha, or truth force. In every land, the truth, once known, has the power to set us free. Truth also has the power to unite us and bridge the distance between me and we, creating the basis for common effort and shared responsibility. There is an African proverb that says, if you want to go quickly, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. We need to go far, quickly. We must abandon the conceit that individual, isolated, private actions are the answer. They can and do help, but they will not take us far enough without collective action. At the same time, we must ensure that in mobilizing globally, we do not invite the establishment of ideological conformity and a new lockstep ism. That means adopting principles, values, laws, and treaties that release creativity and initiative at every level of society in multifold responses originating concurrently and spontaneously. This new consciousness requires expanding the possibilities inherent in all humanity. The innovators who will devise a new way to harness the sun's energy for pennies or invent an engine that's carbon negative may live in Lagos or Mumbai or Montevideo. We must ensure that entrepreneurs and inventors everywhere on the globe have the chance to change the world. When we unite for a moral purpose that is manifestly good and true, the spiritual energy unleashed can transform us. The generation that defeated fascism throughout the world in the 1940s found in rising to meet their awesome challenge that they had gained the moral authority and long-term vision to launch the Marshall Plan, the United Nations, and a new level of global cooperation and foresight that unified Europe and facilitated the emergence of democracy in Japan, Germany, Italy, and much of the world. One of their visionary leaders said, "It is time we steered by the stars and not by the lights of every passing ship." In the last year of that war, you gave the Peace Prize to a man from my hometown of 2,000 people, Carthage, Tennessee, in the USA. Cordell Hull was described by Franklin Roosevelt as the father of the United Nations. He was an inspiration and hero to my own father, who followed Hull in the Congress and the U.S. Senate, and in his commitment to world peace and global cooperation. My parents spoke often of Hull, always in tones of reverence and admiration. 8 weeks ago, when you announced this prize, the deepest emotion I felt was when I saw the headline in my hometown paper that simply noted I had won the same prize that Cordell Hull had won. In that moment, I knew what my father and mother would have felt were they alive. Just as Hull's generation found moral authority in rising to solve the world crisis caused by fascism, so can we find our greatest opportunity in rising to solve the climate crisis. In the kanji characters used in both Chinese and Japanese, crisis is written with two symbols, the first meaning danger, the second opportunity. By facing and removing the danger of the climate crisis, we have the opportunity to gain the moral authority and vision to vastly increase our own capacity to solve other crises that have been too long ignored. We must understand the connections between the climate crisis and the afflictions of poverty, hunger, HIV, AIDS, and other pandemics. As these problems are linked, so too must be their solutions. We must begin by making the common rescue of the global environment the central organizing principle of the world community. 15 years ago, I made that case at the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. 10 years ago, I presented it in Kyoto. This week, I will urge the delegates in Bali to adopt a bold mandate for a treaty that establishes a universal global cap on emissions and uses the market in emissions trading to efficiently allocate resources to the most effective opportunities for speedy reductions. This treaty should be ratified and brought into effect everywhere in the world by the beginning of 2010, 2 years sooner than presently contemplated. The pace of our response must be accelerated to match the accelerating pace of the crisis itself. Heads of state should meet early next year to review what was accomplished in Bali and take personal responsibility for addressing this crisis. It is not unreasonable to ask, given the gravity of our circumstances, that these heads of state meet every 3 months until this treaty is completed. We also need a moratorium on the construction of any new generating facility that burns coal without the capacity to safely trap and store carbon dioxide. And most important of all, we need to put a price on carbon with a CO2 tax that is then rebated back to the people progressively according to the laws of each nation, in ways that shift the burden of taxation from employment to pollution. This is by far the most effective and simplest way to accelerate solutions to this crisis. The world now needs an alliance, especially of those nations that weigh heaviest in the scales where Earth is in the balance. I salute Europe and Japan for the steps they've taken in recent years to meet the challenge, and the new government in Australia, which has made solving the climate crisis its first priority. But the outcome will be decisively influenced by two nations that are now failing to do enough, the United States and China. While India is also growing fast in importance, it should be absolutely clear that it is the two largest CO2 emitters, and most of all my own country, that will need to make the boldest moves or stand accountable before history for their failure to act. Both countries should stop using the other's behavior as an excuse for stalemate and instead develop an agenda for mutual survival in a shared global environment. These are the last few years of decision, but they can be the first years of a bright and hopeful future if we do what we must. No one should believe a solution will be found without effort, without cost, without change. Let us acknowledge that if we wish to redeem squandered time and speak again with moral authority, then these are the hard truths. The way ahead is difficult. The outer boundary of what we currently believe to be feasible is still far short of what we actually must do. Moreover, between here and there, across the unknown, falls the shadow. That is just another way of saying that we have to expand the boundaries of what is possible. In the words of the Spanish poet Antonio Machado, "Pathwalker, there is no path. You must make the path as you walk." We are standing at the most fateful fork in that path. So I want to end as I began, with a vision of two futures, each a palpable possibility, and with a prayer that we will see with vivid clarity the necessity of choosing between those two futures and the urgency of making the right choice now. The great Norwegian playwright Henrik Ibsen wrote, "One of these days, the younger generation will come knocking at my door." The future is knocking at our door right now. Make no mistake, the next generation will ask us one of two questions. Either they will ask, "What were you thinking? Why didn't you act?" Or they will ask instead, "How did you find the moral courage to rise and successfully resolve a crisis that so many said was impossible to solve?" We have everything we need to get started, save perhaps political will. But political will is a renewable resource. So let us renew it, and let us say together, we have a purpose. We are many. For this purpose, we will rise and we will act.
Former Vice President Al Gore accepting the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. From Oslo, Al Gore is expected to go on to Bali, Indonesia, where a major global climate summit is taking place. Gore won the award along with the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The UN's climate panel groups 2,500 researchers from more than 130 nations. Panel Chair Rajendra Pachauri accepted the Nobel on their behalf.
"Coming as I do from India, a land which gave birth to civilization in ancient times, where much of the earlier tradition and wisdom guides actions even in modern times, the philosophy of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means the whole universe is one family, must dominate global efforts to protect the global commons. This principle is crucial to the maintenance of peace and order today, as it would be increasingly in the years ahead, and as the well-known columnist and author Thomas Friedman has highlighted in his book, The World is Flat. Neglect in protecting our heritage of natural resources could prove extremely harmful for the human race and for all species that share common space on planet Earth. Indeed, there are many lessons in human history which provide adequate warning about the chaos and destruction that could take place if we remain guilty of myopic indifference to the progressive erosion and decline of nature's resources. Much has been written, for instance, about the Maya civilization, which flourished during 250 to 950 AD, but collapsed largely as a result of serious and prolonged drought. Even earlier, some 4,000 years ago, a number of well-known Bronze Age cultures also crumbled, extending from the Mediterranean to the Indus Valley, including the civilizations which had blossomed in Mesopotamia. More recent examples of societies that collapsed or faced chaos on account of depletion or degradation of natural resources include the Khmer Empire in Southeast Asia, Eastern Ireland, and several others. Changes in climate have historically determined periods of peace as well as conflict. Further, in recent years, several groups have studied the link between climate and security. These have raised the threat of dramatic population migration, conflict, and war over water and other resources, as well as a realignment of power among nations. Some also highlight the possibility of rising tensions between rich and poor nations, health problems caused particularly by water shortages and crop failures, as well as concerns over nuclear proliferation. One of the most significant aspects of the impacts of climate change, which unfortunately has not received adequate attention from scholars in the social sciences, relates to the equity implications of changes that are occurring and are likely to occur in the future. In general, the impacts of climate change on some of the poorest and most vulnerable communities in the world could prove extremely unsettling. And given the inadequacy of capacity, economic strength, and institutional capabilities characterizing some of these communities, they would remain extremely vulnerable to the impacts of climate change and may therefore actually see a decline in the economic condition with a loss of livelihoods and opportunities to maintain even subsistence levels of existence.
Rajendra Pachauri accepting the Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We'll be back with him in a minute. Performed by Salman Ahmad and Samir Chat at the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony in Oslo's City Hall. We return to Rajendra Pachauri accepting the Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which he chairs.
IPCC, by its very nature, is an organization that does not provide assessments which are policy prescriptive. It has not provided any directions on how conflicts inherent in the social implications of the impacts of climate change could be avoided or contained. Nevertheless, the fourth assessment report provides scientific findings that other scholars can study and arrive at some conclusions on in relation to peace and security. Several parts of our reports have much information and knowledge that would be of considerable value for individual researchers and think tanks dealing with security issues, as well as governments that necessarily are concerned with some of these matters. It would be particularly relevant to conduct in-depth analysis of risks to security among the most vulnerable sectors and communities impacted by climate change across the globe. Peace can be defined as security and the secure access to resources that are essential for living. A disruption in such access could prove disruptive of peace. In this regard, climate change will have several implications, as numerous adverse impacts are expected for some populations in terms of access to clean water, access to sufficient food, stable health conditions, ecosystem resources, security of settlements. Climate change is expected to exacerbate current stresses on water resources. On a regional scale, mountain snowpack, glaciers, and small ice caps play a crucial role in fresh water availability. Widespread mass losses from glaciers and reductions in snow cover over recent decades are projected to accelerate throughout the 21st century. Reducing water availability, hydropower potential, and the changing seasonality of flows in regions supplied by meltwater from major mountain ranges, such as the Hindu Kush, the Himalayas, the Andes, where more than one-sixth of the world's population currently lives. There's also high confidence that many semi-arid regions, such as the Mediterranean basin, western United States, southern Africa, and northeastern Brazil, will suffer a decrease in water resources due to climate change. In Africa, by 2020, between 75 and 250 million people are projected to be exposed to increased water stress due to climate change. Climate change could further adversely affect food security and exacerbate malnutrition at low latitudes, especially in seasonally dry and tropical regions where crop productivity is projected to decrease for even small temperature increases such as 1 to 2 degrees Celsius. By 2020, in some African countries, yields from rain-fed agriculture could be reduced by up to 50%. Agricultural production, including access to food in many African countries, is projected to be severely compromised. The health status of millions of people is projected to be affected through, for example, increases in malnutrition, increased deaths, diseases, and injury due to extreme weather events, increased burden of diarrheal disease, increased frequency of cardiorespiratory diseases due to higher concentrations of ground-level ozone in urban areas related to climate change, and altered spatial distribution of some infectious diseases. As far as security of human settlements is concerned, vulnerabilities to climate change are generally greater in certain high-risk locations, particularly coastal and riverine areas, and areas where economies are closely linked with climate-sensitive resources. Where extreme weather events become more intense or more frequent with climate change, the economic and social costs of these events will increase. Some regions are likely to be especially affected by climate change, the Arctic, because of the impacts of high rates of projected warming on natural systems and human communities. Africa, because of low adaptive capacity and projected climate change impacts. Small islands, where there is high exposure of population and infrastructure to projected climate change impacts. Asian and African megadeltas, due to large populations and high exposure to sea level rise, storm surges, and river flooding. Within other areas, even those with high incomes, some people, such as the poor, young children, and the elderly, could be particularly at risk. Migration and movement of people is a particularly critical source of potential conflict. Migration, usually temporary and often from rural to urban areas, is a common response to calamities such as floods and famines. Another issue of extreme concern is the finding that anthropogenic factors could lead to some impacts that are abrupt or irreversible, depending on the rate and magnitude of climate change. For instance, partial loss of ice sheets on polar land could imply meters of sea level rise, major changes in coastlines, and inundation of low-lying areas, with greatest effects in river deltas and low-lying islands. The implications of these changes, if they were to occur, would be grave and disastrous. However, it is within the reach of human society to meet these threats. The impacts of climate change can be limited by suitable adaptation measures and stringent mitigation of greenhouse gas emissions. Societies have a long record of adapting to the impacts of weather and climate, but climate change today poses novel risks, often outside the range of experience, such as impacts related to drought, heat waves, accelerated glacier threat, and hurricane intensity. The global community needs to coordinate a far more proactive effort towards implementing adaptation measures in the most vulnerable communities and systems in the world. Adaptation is essential to address the impacts arising from warming, which is already unavoidable due to past emissions. But adaptation alone is not expected to cope with all the projected effects of climate change, and especially not in the long run, as most impacts increase in magnitude. There is fortunately substantial potential for the mitigation of global greenhouse gas emissions over the coming decades that could offset the projected growth of global emissions or reduce emissions below current levels. There are multiple drivers for actions that can reduce emissions of greenhouse gases, and they can produce multiple benefits at the local level in terms of economic development and poverty alleviation, employment, energy security, and local environmental protection. The fourth assessment report has assessed the costs of mitigation in the coming decades for a number of scenarios of stabilization of the concentration of these gases and associated average global temperature increases at equilibrium. A stabilization level of 445 to 590 parts per million of CO2 equivalent, which corresponds to a global average temperature increase above pre-industrial levels at equilibrium of around 2 to 2.4 degrees Celsius, would lead to a reduction in average GDP growth rate of less than 0.12% annually up to 2030 and beyond up to 2050. Essentially, the range of global GDP reduction with this least cost trajectory assessed for this level of stabilization would be less than 3% of the global GDP in 2030 and less than 5.5% in 2050. Some important characteristics of this stabilization scenario need careful consideration. For a CO2 equivalent concentration at stabilization of 445 to 490 parts per million, CO2 emissions would need to peak during the period 2000 to 2015 and decline thereafter. We therefore have a short window of time to bring about a reduction in global emissions if we wish to limit temperature increases to around 2 degrees Celsius at equilibrium. But even with this ambitious level of stabilization, the global average sea level rise above pre-industrial at equilibrium from thermal expansion alone would lie between 0.4 to 1.4 meters. This would have serious implications for several regions and locations in the world. A rational approach to management of risk would require that human society evaluates the impacts of climate change inherent in a business as usual scenario and the quantifiable costs as well as unquantifiable damages associated with it against the cost of action. With such an approach, the overwhelming result would be in favor of major efforts at mitigation. The impacts of climate change, even with current levels of concentration of greenhouse gases, would be serious enough to justify stringent mitigation measures. Science tells us not only that the climate system is changing, but also that further warming and sea level rise is in store, even if greenhouse gases were to be stabilized today. That is a consequence of the basic physics of the system. Social factors also contribute to our future, including the lock-in due, for example, to today's power plants, transportation systems and buildings, and their likely continuing emissions, even as cleaner future infrastructure comes online. So, the challenge before us is not only a large one, it is also one in which every year of delay implies a commitment to greater climate change in the future. It would be relevant to recall the words of President Gayoom of the Maldives at the 42nd session of the UN General Assembly in 1987, and I quote, "As for my own country, the Maldives, a mean sea level rise of 2 meters would suffice to virtually submerge the entire country of 1,190 small islands, most of which barely rise 2 meters above sea level. That would be the death of a nation. With a mere 1 meter rise also, a storm surge would be catastrophic and possibly fatal to the nation." On 22nd September 1997, at the opening of the 13th session of the IPCC at Male, the capital of the Maldives, President Gayoom reminded us again of the threat to his country when he said, and I quote, "10 years ago, in April 1987, this very spot where we are gathered now was under 2 feet of water, as unusually high waves inundated one-third of Male, as well as the Male International Airport and several other islands of our archipelago." End of quote. Hazards from the impacts of climate change are therefore a reality today in some parts of the world, and we cannot hide under global averages and the ability of affluent societies to deal with climate-related threats, as opposed to the condition of vulnerable communities in poor regions of the globe. How climate change will affect peace is for others to determine, but we have provided scientific assessment of what could become a basis for conflict. When Mr. Willy Brandt spoke at the acceptance of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1971, he said, and I quote, "We shall have to know more about the origins of conflicts. As I see it, next to reasonable politics, learning is in our world the true credible alternative to force." Therefore, at a fundamental level, the world now has to create knowledge and practice on a path of development which is not resource degrading and carbon intensive. Human ingenuity and strength are capable of meeting this challenge. Dr. Gro Brundtland told us 20 years ago of the importance of sustainable development as the path to peace and prosperity. We need to commit ourselves to this path before it is too late. The 13th Conference of the Parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change is being held in Bali right now. The world's attention is riveted on that meeting, and hopes are alive that, unlike the sterile outcome of previous sessions in recent years, this one will provide some positive results. The work of the IPCC has helped the world to learn more on all aspects of climate change, and the Nobel Peace Prize Committee has acknowledged this fact. The question is whether the participants in Bali will support what Willy Brandt referred to as reasonable politics. Will those responsible for decisions in the field of climate change at the global level listen to the voice of science and knowledge, which is loud and clear? If they do so at Bali and beyond, then all my colleagues in the IPCC and those thousands toiling for the cause of science would feel doubly honored at the privilege I am receiving today on their behalf. Thank you very much.
Rajendra Pachauri, chair of the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. As the IPCC and Al Gore received the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, negotiators entered the final week of talks at the UN Climate Conference in Bali. The meeting hit a roadblock Monday from the United States. The U.S. announced it won't approve a draft agreement setting firm targets for cuts to carbon pollution. The Bush administration says a proposal for developed nations to reduce emissions by between 25% and 40% by 2020 is totally unrealistic and unhelpful. The 25-40% figure is based on the work of the UN's IPCC. Harlan Watson, the senior climate negotiator for the United States, said the panel's calculation was based on, quote, many uncertainties. Efforts to reform U.S. environmental policy are also stalling on Capitol Hill. On Friday, Republicans blocked a Senate vote on the House-approved energy bill. The Bush administration and leading Republicans oppose the measure. They've singled out provisions that would impose $21 billion in taxes on the oil and gas industry and require utility companies to draw 15% of their power from renewable sources by the year 2020. Ted Glick is the coordinator of the U.S. Climate Emergency Council. He's heading to Capitol Hill today to protest Republican opposition to the energy bill. Ted Glick is now on the 99th day of his fast to protest the failure of Congress to address climate change. Joining us from Washington, D.C., Ted Glick, welcome. Your thoughts on these speeches of the Nobel Peace Laureates.
Yes, thanks, first of all, Amy, for having me on the program. A couple things about Pachauri's speech. He talked about conflicts over water. We have conflicts right now over oil. We have wars for oil. We have to be clear that right now there are conflicts over continuing the same path that we have to get off of. We have to end wars for oil. But he was very good in terms of the equity issue. We have to understand that this is an issue of climate justice. Those who are most affected already and will be most affected as this crisis unfolds are people in Africa, people in Asia, low-income people, people in the Caribbean hit by more destructive hurricanes, people in the United States hit by hurricanes that most impact, as we saw in New Orleans, low-income people, particularly people of color. As far as Al Gore, I was interested in his solutions, what he put forward in terms of solutions. It was important that he called for a moratorium on coal plants. Can't build any more coal plants, absolutely, anywhere in the United States, and really it shouldn't be happening anywhere in the world. He talked about tax shifting, the need to shift taxes from being on payroll or on sales taxes, for example, to taxes on carbon. That absolutely is the way to go. That's the way we have to go in this country. My concern, he talked about the cap and trade system. What we need is a cap and reduce system. Maybe some trading's involved of emissions, carbon emissions permits, but the emphasis has to be on reduction. We can't let major corporate interests, utilities, coal companies, oil companies, game a cap and trade system, which we've had experience with, actually, internationally and in Europe. As far as Congress, there was the beginnings of a turn in the direction that we need to go that took place on Thursday when the House of Representatives voted a pretty good energy bill. To the credit of Nancy Pelosi and others who worked with her, it's a good beginning. That was smashed down the next morning on Friday by the Senate with the Republican Party voting overwhelmingly to reject this House bill. There's now negotiations going on, try to come up with a revised version in the Senate. Today, about an hour from now, as I'm talking here in D.C., at 10 o'clock, a number of us are going to the office of Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, and we're going to be sitting in his office at 10 a.m. It's in the Russell Building, Constitution Avenue, room 361A. Anybody in the D.C. area who can join us, we'd love to have you there in support. We need to stand up for the future, stand up for justice and our climate. We cannot accept people like Mitch McConnell and George Bush and Dick Cheney and the rest of them who are I would say advisedly climate criminals. I think that's an accurate phrase to describe what has been the reality under the Republican administration for the last 7 years. What's happening is really criminal, facing what we are facing in this world.
Explain what the Republicans are opposed to in this bill. And if you can talk about what Harvey Wasserman talks about, King Kong madness. That's CONG, coal, oil, nukes, and gas.
Yes. Coal, oil, nukes, and gas. If you want to talk about who it is that is the target, who it is that's preventing what needs to happen in this world, there you go. The coal industry, the oil industry, the nukes, natural gas industry. We have to be clear that we have to overcome those corporations, those entities. In terms of what is happening, what the Republicans are opposed to, they are opposed to renewable energy. They are opposed to energy from the wind, from the sun, from the tides, from the earth, the heat of the earth. They literally don't want to have anything or virtually anything in an energy bill in the year 2007 that supports renewables. Again, to me, that's criminal. They also want to protect their friends in the oil industry. There's about $13.5 billion of to help finance the renewable energy piece in the House bill. There's about $13.5 billion of tax breaks that were removed by the House bill that the Republican senators, supported by a very few Democrats, want to put back in. Again, we have to be clear on who it is that is obstructing forward progress, obstructing it by their dominance over major players, many of those in our federal government, as well as other levels of government. And we cannot accept it, and we have to take strong action. We have to make sacrifices. We have to be willing to go to jail. Al Gore himself, a couple of months ago, talked about how young people need to be sitting in front of the coal plants to prevent coal plants from being built. That's true. Young people need to be doing that. Middle-aged people need to be doing that. Older people need to be doing that. And Al Gore needs to be doing that. Let's get serious about this crisis.
Ted Glick, how do you think so clearly, 99 days into this climate emergency fast, as you call it?
Well, what I've discovered is that I'm much more focused. I really am. My mind is much more focused as a result of this fast on what's really important. I've had experience with fasting before, and I've found that to be true in the past, that when you're fasting about something every hour, really, every hour, every waking hour, sometimes in your dreams, you are thinking about why it is that you are putting yourself through this, why you're not eating, in my case, for 25 days, nothing. It was on water only, and since then it's been liquids, so it's been no solid
food.
Ted
Glick, we only have 30 seconds. In this period of almost 100 days that you've been fasting and been in Washington, do you sense any kind of change?
There are political changes happening in the country without question. Even in the Republican Party, 77% of Republicans, according to a Zogby poll, support renewable energy, want utilities to be producing more from renewables as far as their energy production.
You're going to sit in McConnell's office, or are you going to leave?
No, I'm not leaving. Other people are not leaving. If they arrest us, they arrest us.
Ted Glick, I want to thank you for being with us, coordinator of the U.S. Climate Emergency Council. He's in the 99th day of a climate emergency fast in Washington, D.C. And that does it for our broadcast. If you want to get a copy of today's show, go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Fodokadus Aramate, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo. I'll be in Washington celebrating WPFW on Saturday night at the Washington Convention Center. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.